what the state of Alaska needs to do there is to be sure that under some new structure that the viability of our local companies would continue to be guaranteed. So all of these things would combine, I think, should urge you to approach any kind of telephone deregulation, especially as it relates to rural telephone companies, with a great deal of caution because of the great sensitivity of the small local companies to these problems of toll settlements.
I'm going to expand a little bit on this. I came in late. I apologize for being away. I had to make some phone calls. Telephone settlements are as simple as arguing over a piece of pie after four people have agreed it's community property. At least they know among the four of us that all the pie is supposed to belong to them. Of course, if one of them is a private entity, maybe the federal government ends up getting part of their piece. But once you start with that simplification, it turns into a bloody mess. And the perceptions are based upon old grindings of axes going back 25 and 30 years. Ma Bell wants Congress to believe, for instance, that what you refer to as a something like a subsidization of Alaskan rural areas, also it happens to happen with regard to rural areas in North Dakota and elsewhere, is a bad thing. On the other hand, isn't the ratepayer in New York or Florida or Honolulu or in Los Angeles have a vested interest in making sure that there's a reliable telecommunication system throughout the United States and that he can get a call through, and that he can get a call anywhere he wishes, and isn't that part of what he pays his phone bill in order to assure? And the economic problems, this is one of the few areas where practically everybody in the subject matter is in the same bed when we go off to Washington. We have our fights tooth and nail with Alaska and some other areas, but Alaska, of course, in its own self-interest, wants more of the money that AT&T would otherwise get in order to have peace and make sure that they can interconnect and provide the service that their customers want. They want to make sure that they're competent local utilities, and they need money, too. And some of the formulas and some of the settlements things end up seeming very strange. If you just look at them, it looks like it's something like a subsidy or something unfair, but you have to look really at the whole country. And of course, that's what the Federal Communications Commission started saying they were doing in the proceedings that have resulted in the establishment of the joint board. Of course, another thing involving telephone, I suppose if I were up here and not knowing that I had to decide this later and not now, I would also mention that it's pretty hard to talk about deregulation of telephone utilities. Then under at least the current Communications Act and the FCC regulations, who would sit on a joint board? And therefore, would we abdicate any state involvement in deciding what the separations are and therefore whether or not this gentleman's company goes out of business?
Thank you. Are there any further questions? Thank you.
Thank you very much, sir. Did you have something, Mr. Will?
No, I have no questions.
Not for this witness? Okay.
No. Mr. Chairman, I'd like to break in right now then. We have no more people scheduled to formally testify, but I'd like to go through the list of people that are here as observers that specifically may wish to comment on either utility or telecommunications regulation, find out if they changed their minds subsequent to initially arriving.
Is there anyone here who wishes to testify who has not indicated on the slip that he filled out, he or she filled out earlier, that you have to testify? Mr. Siebert?
We still have, Mr. Chairman, we still have three people who have indicated a willingness to testify or a wish to testify, but it relates to the recommendation on the merger of the APUC
yeah.
with the ATC and the APC.
But you're saying with regard to the direct matters?
Right.
Okay. Mr. Siebert, we have, you indicated, is there anyone else who wishes to change their little sign-up sheet on interest to testify? It's my understanding we have one reporter in Fairbanks who did have, and no one else in the circuit. Is there any different information?
I would like to poll the station.
If you would, please.
Both for Juno, if you're still there, do you have anyone who wishes to testify, or have you already gone home?
Probably home. Door to the barrel.
I'm waiting to drop off. Juno is evidently clear. Maxine in Fairbanks, are you still operational, or has everybody...
still here, but the last one is just leaving.
Would that be Mr. Spencer?
Mr. Spencer left about 10 minutes ago. This is Mr. Mockerman leaving now.
Oh, yeah.
Very good. Thank you. Fairbanks, you can go ahead and drop off the net, and that means that we will be closing down.
Or if you want to listen, you can do that, too.
It's going home time for them there.
Thank you. Fairbanks will be clear, then.
All right, thank you. And if there are there any other stations on the net that wish to continue to monitor, would you please report in? Otherwise, we can discontinue using the microphones for the telecommunications portion.
Or maybe for the whole meeting.
We're just suspend them. Barring any particular comment from Nome or any of the other locations, then we are finished with the teleconference network. We can free it up. Carol downstairs, if you want to just clear the lines for us, we can just proceed without pushing buttons now.
Okay, the meeting is not adjourned, however. We will go off the teleconference line since there's nobody there and continue in this room.
Should turn the volume down.
Okay.
Okay, now we go to the ATC.
Okay, part of the recommendation, of course, of the auditor involves, you going to leave us? Oh, I'm shocked. Involves a possible combination of the three regulatory agencies. There are several people who wish to testify on that matter. I believe Mr. Bedsworth is one of those people. Is he still here? Yes. Join us if you would, please. Ms. Munson had to leave. I think Mr. Randolph's coming back. And Senator Sturgalewski is in the office making a phone call. She accepts his phone calls, whatever. Yes, if you would, Mr. Bedsworth.
I'd like to thank the committee for the opportunity. My name is William Bedsworth. I'm employed full-time in the Transportation Commission. However, I'm not here representing the Transportation Commission. I also, on alternate semesters, teach a course in regulation of industry for the University of Alaska, and I'm not here representing the university either. As a matter of fact, I'm on annual leave and just representing myself.
And it's your understanding that the commissioners and the director there would not object if you offered your personal testimony at this time? You have no reason to believe that they would object.
No, I have no reason to believe that they would object.
Yes, go ahead.
Quite briefly, on page 9 of the report, third paragraph, the suggestion that certain cooperatives be allowed to withdraw from regulation, and then the next paragraph, certain size utilities, I think it says less than $100,000 annual gross revenues, that these be allowed to withdraw from regulation. I'd like to suggest, and I'm sure it's redundant, but in any event, that the committee recognize that this places a burden on the public to take affirmative action to come forward in the event of some disgruntlement on their part. And this burden is quite a burden on the public because it involves costs. So if an appeal process to the APUC is allowed by the public who feel that they their board is not responsive or that the smaller utility is not performing as it should, I think that these appeals should be made cost-free to the public. Perhaps the cost-free nature of it should be after some investigation to determine it's not a frivolous or troublemaking appeal, but nevertheless that the public should have access to legal counsel or some kind of representation before the PUC in order to convey their interests. That's all on that point. Now, I have some others. With regard to the merger, for a short period of time after law school, I was employed by the Kansas Corporation Commission. The Kansas Corporation Commission is an integrated regulatory agency. In other words, it covers transportation, pipelines, and what we call the PUC. Bluntly, the Kansas Corporation Commission works. My job there was as a chief auditor representing the public, and I was able to see Kansas Corporation operate, and one could tell from their musty files that they'd been there a long time. And
it is claimed, at least on the Alaskan basis, that that's also true of the commission that you work for.
Musty files?
Some of the antagonists even talked about the possibility of cobwebs coming around, at least some of your colleagues.
We're talking about administrative lag.
Yes.
comment on administrative lag. If you have any questions about the Kansas Corporation Commission, I'd like to answer them if I could. But moving on, if there is a merger or if there is not, I'm sure the legislature is interested in perhaps making some changes in regulation in the state. And I'd like to recommend that a close look be taken at the fact that we are creating permit values here. Permits being the name I use for certificates, operating certificates, or permits, or licenses, what have you. In a regulated industry, you grant an effect. setting up a contract, at least, saying to the operator, if you provide the operator, if you provide the service that we are requiring you to provide in the manner that we're requiring you to provide it, we in turn will see to it that you have no competition as long as there is no additional public convenience and necessity for that competition. So this gives the operator the opportunity to come in and try to show that there is no public convenience and necessity. And, economic pressure can be applied to keep out new applicants and so forth. That's not really an evil. The evil part seems to me to be that a permit holder, well, an applicant comes in, he has nothing on his balance sheet except his own personal assets. As soon as we grant him a certificate, he's picked up $25,000 to $150,000, whatever the market is for the kind of permit that he's receiving. Now, this wouldn't be evil either if this was a function of the operator's excellent or efficient service. But mind you, he picked this up immediately upon getting the certificate. So it makes no difference whether he's efficient or inefficient or a clod or, the world's answer to everything. But what happens is that these permits are then traded on the market in spite of the best efforts of the commission to prevent this sort of thing. You cannot outwit the public. They are always thinking, and that's one of the reasons we are developing at all, I think, because our people are always thinking. On the other hand, those values that people receive for the sale of their permits, even though the commission policy doesn't allow the sale of the permit, that value belongs, I think, to the taxpayer, because it is created solely by the state by giving the persons who receive a permit some protection against competition. So we'll take an air taxi operator. He comes into a village and says, I want to operate, and the commission gives him a hearing, and everyone says that we need him, and he's granted a certificate. 6 months later, he can be on his way to Florida with $50,000 in his pocket. And I think $50,000 belongs to the state. This doesn't prevent him from selling his airplane. It doesn't prevent him from selling his real property he might own. It doesn't prevent him from selling his goodwill. If he's done a good job and he has customers and they are loyal and they recognize his name and good service he provided, he can sell that. But I think he ought to turn the certificate back to the commission. And then the commission can, in my opinion, avoid in transfers of certificates. This is not I'm not talking about new certificates in a new area, but a transfer of certificates from Jones to Smith. Jones turns a certificate into the state. The state turns around and advertises that the certificate is available and says any qualified person may purchase this certificate at auction. So we may have two or three air taxi operators come forward and say, we would like to serve in Kipnuk or whatever, and we have the money, we have the airplanes, we have the expertise, and we're willing to prove it. And they come forward, and this outbid $25,000 for the certificate, and then nobody else comes forward with that, or no one.
Do you think that this is a general thing that applies in the various areas where there are regulatory commissions across the board in the jurisdiction? Probably wouldn't apply to the APC. It's possible it could apply to the APC, and we know it applies to the ATC.
Yeah, we know it applies to the ATC, and that's really all I'm speaking for now. I think the permit values belong to the state, and
the abuses are possible even within the jurisdiction of the APUC.
Oh yeah, it's very difficult.
If it's on what he's currently testing,
exactly.
He's not really finished. But go ahead.
Okay, exactly. Same thing. I have difficulty understanding why the state should get $25,000 out of this. They gave it away once for nothing. Why not just give it to the next person rather than again?
The permit has value.
Had value the first guy gave it to.
Yes. And right now I'm moving along with the notion that these things are being traded. They have economic value. And if you sell it, you can avoid a public convenience necessity type hearing because if a person's willing to put his money
sure.
in a situation, then...
Well, okay.
Well, that's just a small
point.
Okay.
I see what you get at.
But if you do not sell it, in my opinion, the permit is going to be sold by someone.
Well, not if it turned back to the state.
No.
If it returned back to the state, it wouldn't be sold by anybody other than the state. And you just kind of, it's almost a matter of semantics, the type of hearing you're having.
I understand.
And so
yes.
Why should, you know...
Well, I suppose things fall apart this late in the afternoon. We really should wait to let you continue. But
right.
Since you started, I'll jump in here too. How's that?
Well, you started. I was following.
Okay.
That's true.
Sure. I don't tell you.
Running libertarian revisionist, or whatever the Maoists would say. The question that I'm sure is in the mind of many members of the committee and some of the people out there behind you listening, is even though this might be styled an abuse, and even though we've seen it in the ATC and it could spread, it certainly happens with regard to the Alcohol Beverage Control Board. We found that out. Although we didn't find any liquor license that had sold for $500,000, and we did find some ATC certificates that had sold for $500,000. Yeah, I don't know what limited entry permits are going for, but on the other hand, that's a commercial reality. And whether it's good or bad or resulted from abuses of how the regulatory scheme was supposed to work, it is something that businessmen who are stuck with the status quo have made decisions with regard to. And it is claimed by people with that attitude that very often somebody will build up his business, and he does have the goodwill of his business, that's true, but the convention that's arisen in the industry is that the value of the business is attached to the certificate. Maybe it should really be attached to the goodwill and to, you know, the management, if you buy the management intact or something, but that's the way it works. Now, if we were to have a change of this sort here, maybe to head off a tendency that could arise in this direction in the APUC and as a model to try to clean up the mess with regard to booze, and or any other regulatory area was happening, how could we do it on a transitional basis without really causing panic out in the hinterlands or even right here in Anchorage?
Well, fortunately, I'm not a legislator.
Well, I mean, presuming that we were to do something like that or in that direction, wouldn't we have to have some kind of a transitional period so we wouldn't scare the bejesus out of everybody?
Well, you're going to have people that are, for example, they've been an air taxi operator for 20 years, and they're now 60 years old, and they're looking forward, they've been planning to sell that certificate.
That's what I meant, reliance on the status quo, whether it was, they didn't cause it, the marketplace and good or bad activity of the commission or its inactivity caused it, but they're stuck with it now and they're going to retire. Now, what do you do with that?
Mr. Chairman.
Well, let him finish. I interrupted his answer.
I really don't have an answer for you. I really don't.
Well, don't you think it would be plausible that if the legislature proposed something like that, that there would be some kind of a transitional period to alleviate the problem?
I think it would be well advised.
Particularly in an election year, Mr. Randolph.
the state created the problem, let the state buy them back.
Aha!
That takes care of the big
spender from Libertarians.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Sturgill-Whiskey.
Yes, I think one thing that...
That's Sturgill-Whiskey, isn't it?
Sturgill-Whiskey or whatever, that's fine. I know who I am. I think one of the things implicit in what Mr. Bidworth was saying went a little bit further than the question of the value that's created, and that's the quality, perhaps, of the economic regulation. And I'm not so sure there's not an ability to, if that certificate of need and necessity is not adequately done on the basis of appropriate economic information, then there's almost a culpability, if you will, on the part of ATUC or ATC in the value of that license. Did I catch a hint of that? In other words, if you're going to do it and then the operator goes south, we've got a problem. We've really been party to creating wealth, and we're not getting at least even a return for it for the people that are supposed to be served.
Yeah, I'm not sure that there's many that pick up a permit and then sell it quickly without much in the way of service. I think everyone serves, and you know, all of us change our minds. We get into one line of business, and then after a while, a year or so, we decide we don't like that after all. We want to get out. So there are some things that may look worse than other things because of the length of time someone's been serving. It can look as if someone got a certificate just for the sheer purpose of speculating with it, holding it for a little while, building up a small business, and then selling it to someone who may be a little starry-eyed and is willing to pay a bundle for it. I'm not sure that any of these things have been done. But I may have also created a little bit of a false impression when I answered him, too. I said something about public convenience necessity, and it caused him to stop. And then I should add that we don't have public convenience necessity hearings in transfers, because the implicit assumption is that's already settled. And what we're doing here is just changing from Jones to Smith, and all we want to do is find out if Smith has an airplane.
You don't. You do fit, willing, and able, but not public convenience.
That's right. And so that wasn't really fair to me to say that we can avoid public convenience necessity hearing. So I'll move on if there are no further
questions. Go ahead. We did it in an unorthodox way.
Okay. This goes back also to the Kansas Corporation Commission. I was impressed with them while I worked for them.
What years were that? Was that?
That was in 1974. I left law school as a late bloomer and went to work for the Kansas Corporation Commission as a financial consultant. I worked for them for about a month in that position, and they hired me full-time.
So you were there from when to when?
From June 74 until I began work for the ATC in January 75, about 6 months. And I was their chief auditor, they called me in Kansas. Anyway, the way the Kansas Corporation Commission is funded is that, first of all, they demand from every regulated firm in the state a set of accounting records that are standardized across the state so that everyone in the state that is regulated by the Kansas Corporation Commission has the same kind of accounts.
And these are people who collect garbage and have telephone businesses and are
pipelines,
are truckers and
right.
But they don't regulate air, do they?
I don't remember.
I don't think they do.
All of these people have to file their annual reports, which a set of financial statements in effect, balance sheet and profit and loss statement. And as soon as that comes in, the Kansas Corporation Commission looks at the gross sales and then levies a fee to every regulated firm in the state based upon their gross sales. The state of Alaska may want to do some in some other way. The point is, in Kansas, there are no tax funds going into regulated industries. The whole thing is paid for by the industries that are regulated.
Well, of course, I assume that Kansas doesn't have our constitution. I mean, that's a good idea, but we will not theirs. But, of course, you know that we don't have dedicated funds in Alaska. And some of us at least have the opinion that that constitutional provision, the spirit as well as the letter of it, ought to be followed, although the governor of Alaska doesn't seem to have that opinion, at least when it comes to regulating booze. Go ahead.
One thing I can say is that I'm completely innocent of politics. So whatever you say, Senator, is all right with me.
Representative.
I just understand. I'm merely telling you that what works in another state. Then my last comment, I have another comment here, but I think it's redundant to tell you that transportation is really a hidden cost in this state. Consumers don't realize how much transportation is costing them. Every dollar that they spend includes a fee for some transportation. And we do not have the ability to regulate transportation costs in the state. This may seem to be a put down for the Transportation Commission, but it is not. It's merely a statement of fact. When you compare the expertise at PUC for regulating rates, and then you compare the kind of data that we have to work with, and even the basic theory that is utilized in transportation regulation, you'll find that there isn't any rate regulation in transportation.
We did find that out during the hearings.
So you end up granting, not monopoly, but granting limited competition, and then taking the lid off. In effect, what you're doing, or what, not what you're doing, but what has happened. All right, finally, I think hearing officers, whether they're full-time or temporary, in regulated industries, must be somehow kept separate from the agency's regulator. I think this is important.
You mean the agency staff or the commission that is the final quasi-judicial decider?
I think they should be separate from the commission staff and the commission,
and
the ultimate decider.
And you think this is good as a matter of general regulatory theory, no matter which commission we're talking about?
That's right. Over the long run. And this also applies to temporary hearing officers that are just called in for an hour from the bar. It's easy to understand, I think, with temporary, but if you call in, say you're the school board and you're having a hearing, you need an outside attorney, you call in an attorney and he wants to be called in again later. And this doesn't necessarily provide objectivity in his response. He's going to perhaps lean more towards the school board than towards the public in that particular example I gave you. This doesn't aim at any particular attorney or any particular event. It's merely an example.
Everybody wants to keep buying groceries. Nothing wrong with that.
That's right. And that's all that I have.
I have some questions. Clearly, one thing we could do, well, we could go ahead and abolish everything, I suppose, or something like that. Or we could follow the recommendation of the auditor, combine the three regulatory agencies, throw in the ABC and the Board of Doorknob Manufacturers, I suppose. Or we could investigate an area that came out of a series of questions I had a previous witness, and that is, what has been done in other jurisdictions, a pool of hearing officers and economic specialists that are familiar with regulation of various industries. to be available to each regulator as needed. I asked a previous witness whether he felt that there was sufficient general common information and common skills required so that you could have a hearing officer who one week could be, if that was all he did, be a hearing officer for the Alcohol Beverage Control Board, 2 weeks later for the for one of the smaller applications for the APUC, 5 months later for the Alaska Transportation Commission regarding a air taxi certificate. And then the parallel question is, what about the staff talent problem? Do you think in the area, since this is your field, do you think that someone who is in economic regulation, as a tariff specialist in transportation, or a separations expert in telephone utilities in that area, could double in brass and do the same sort of thing in each of the other regulated industries as called upon by the Alaska Public Utilities Commission, ATC, or the new super agency, or the Alcohol Beverage Control Board, for instance?
Yes, first of all...
of course, there's not economic regulation with regard to booze.
First of all, okay. I'd say yes in general, and then go back to the qualifications. First of all, the procedural rules for holding hearings, they have to be standardized across.
Right. Due process.
Yeah, all the way across for everyone, so that the hearing officer doesn't have to be afraid of making procedural errors when he goes from one forum to the next. This can be done. It may be difficult to get all the agencies to agree to what the procedure should be in there, but if a supra-administrative agency set up procedural regulations and impose them, then it could work. So if the hearing officer had a standard set of procedural regulations, if he was educated in a law school, and if he he had a general knowledge of at least one major area, this would give him something to hang his hat on. If you're having a hearing in a new area, for example, say I came and was holding a hearing for the APUC and telephones, they started using new terminology. I just stopped them. I said, what does that mean? And then they'd tell me what it meant. I said, all right, how is that relevant to this case? And they'd tell me that. The hearing would be a little longer. But after
the first hearing, but the second one you had,
it would be shorter. And but as long as the procedural regulations are the same, I'm sure you know already that the feds are doing this sort of thing. And it seems to be working. Although one might say that the one reason for deregulation at the federal level is because of the hearing officers, although I don't know if that's true. But assuming that problem away, the feds can do it. And if they can do it, we can.
Then the parallel thing with regard to the economic specialist, do you feel you've answered that, or do you think it's the same kind of situation?
Well, I think regulation in our state should be more oriented towards the public than it is. I think the public should be represented in every hearing by an aggressive, knowledgeable person, whether he's a lawyer or just an economic expert. I'd much rather, an example in a hearing, have an emotional table pound economist than a lawyer representing the public. I can handle the law. I don't really need lawyers. But I do want someone who's in there representing the public. And
you know, we have a specific statutory guideline in one area of the APUC's jurisdiction that makes the communications carrier section, which ends up being called the Common Carrier Bureau, has an actual advocacy role that's set forth in the statute. And I don't think that's the case with regard to your agency and some of the others, even though that is the common experience in many administrative agencies in Law 48. Well, let me ask a parallel question there. Do you think the ATC needs one if it's kept separate and continues? It seems like you do. Also,
needs one what?
A specific statutory mandate that somebody, staff or a section or something, has an advocacy role and that it should do that. Let me explain the background on that. I don't think Senator Sturzelewski knows this. In 75 or something, I think just before Carolyn came on the commission, the old Subcommittee on Telecommunications of the Legislative Council, the Ninth Legislature, which I chaired, met with then Commissioners Zerbetz, then is now Dick Edwards, and Marv Weatherly, who just came on board, asking, well, what's going wrong? And the major thing that I think was echoed in a comment that Carolyn made this morning was that they have to make a decision on the record And while they always might suspect that maybe the public interest would have required something else, if they go beyond the bounds of their narrow record, then it's not due process, it's irresponsible, it's capricious, arbitrary, and fattening, and therefore they're going to be overturned by court. And therefore they requested us, and we did get through the second session of the Ninth Legislature for the APUC, a provision that set up the communications carrier section and provides a specific advocacy role for part of the staff to advocate for the lowest practicable rate, I think is the words, or is that correct? Practicable was my favorite word, I remember. Do you think that that is appropriate generally in administrative law with regard to agencies that do economic regulation? And I've got another question, but I'll remember what it is when you answer that one.
Okay, yes, my answer is yes. The reason being that, for example, the problems that Chugach Electric has at their annual meetings, the public has more important things to do, they think. And also, since there is so much law involved in the hearings, necessarily so, and some of the economic principles and the background required are so complex because over time things just get that way. They grow and become more complex. The public is in no position at all to come forward and say anything. And they're, I think, cowed by the complexity of the whole matter.
Okay, now I thought of the parallel question, which does directly relate to that, the one I'd forgotten. And that is, okay, suppose we've done this. Isn't this, now I'll take the other side, isn't this too confusing? Because you're a regulatory expert. That's your job, you teach it, you do it. You know, I've been practicing law for 10 years, and Gellhorn and crazy people taught me administrative law, and I did it for a long time. I still do a little bit during federal agency. I know that you know, that we both know, that we have this strange role assignment within a government agency. But shouldn't a government, I suppose someone argue on the other side and say, doesn't that get awfully complicated? I was just speaking to a reporter, this is an example, on the phone, and she's better than some, but she was still trying to find out what can she put into a 90-second summary of this six-hour meeting on tonight's Channel 13 news. You and I know that the most, and probably Commissioner Guest knows, the most common mistake that public information has about an administrative agency, even without the separate advocacy role, is every time the staff makes a recommendation, the reporter is somebody new on the beat who's 19 and a half and just got out of J school with a C-minus average and thinks that the commission or the FCC or the ATC has made a decision, and there's misinformation rampant all over the place. So is there a problem of public understanding of these administrative agencies? And if we're going to say, well, we ought to have this advocacy role that is in one area of the APUC's jurisdiction generally, in the area of economic regulation throughout all the agencies, then aren't we even making it more of a mess? And how do we tell the public how this whole system works without having to hire you or me if we're in the private sector doing that sort of thing?
Well, it takes a lot of experience to represent the public adequately, I think. Commissioner Guest would agree with that. The IRS alone causes innumerable problems probably every year with their changes, which have to be assimilated by the PUC staff and understood. The public cannot do this. And if something isn't done, then the regulatory commissions tend over time, I think, to become industry-oriented. This, you can find this in a textbook, so you know it's not
in any agency in any state or in the federal government.
Yes, and these agencies, I think every one that I've ever seen, had experience with, were staffed with very good people, sincere people, who had perhaps no previous training at all in what the public interest was, and over a period of time they became to equate the public interest with whether or not Joe Smith's dairy was able to raise his prices or not. And Joe Smith learns to work this over time. And the dairy, the milk prices keep going up, and the public never really understands how to fight this situation. And if Chugach can't, even with bringing national television stars, get a quorum for an annual meeting, I don't know how we're going to get the public in to discuss a rate increase or how it will affect them. And transportation particularly is a hidden cost. It's just the people just don't know what's going on.
So you're not quite answering my question. You seem to be saying the dilemma is there, but we just have to do it that way anyway?
No.
That is that we have
to. I think the answer is to set up a consumer advocate within the agency itself so that he can develop that expertise. And if you have a consumer advocate that cuts across all of the agencies, I think you would be creating an unwieldy monster, perhaps. But if you had
there was a bill in on that in the 10th legislature, I think.
There's a bill in right now.
I bet you the ghostwriters change a lot. I just bet you. Go ahead.
Well, within an agency, however, I think that you can take staff, even existing staff, and say, all right, fellas, we don't know what you were thinking before, but from now on, Mrs. Smith out there with her, grocery cart full of groceries is the one you're going to be worried about. And the legislature has told you this is what you're going to do, and they've given us the power to do it. So we want you to find out what these firms are charging. We want you to find out how much they're making, how much it costs to do business, and we want you to come up with a viable a theory, perhaps rate base and rate making, such as PUC, and set rates for these people. And we want you to monitor these rates closely, and we're going to, if you don't know how to do it now, we're going to require you to go back to school and learn how to do it.
Other questions? Staff? Mr. Halpin?
Yeah, it seems like you're aiming at, really, especially in the case of the ATC, plugging up the holes in a system of protection without regulation, basically, by saying, if we're going to regulate, then let's regulate all the way, and if we're going to assume that the competitive factor isn't there to regulate price, then we're going to have a uniform accounting system and a method whereby we, as an agency, being the Transportation Commission or whatever the agency is, can truly protect the public. And the question that comes down there, especially when you start to talk about unified accounting systems and the further complications in the structure itself, is where do you drop out the small entities?
Yes. Yeah, we have some darn good air taxi operators that cannot stand to write numbers down on a piece of paper. And I
remember a lawyer in the legislature who kept carrying his IRS withholding statements around a briefcase for 3 months until he got a rather nasty phone call, too.
I see.
You know, with one employee. Go ahead. I understand the feeling. Go ahead.
Yeah. So, again, I'm not a legislator. You know, it's so easy for me to sit here.
Sounds like you want to be one.
No, thanks, then. But we do need some kind of regulation. I don't know where to stop regulation. The reason I say we need some is because we have a unique state, as you all know better than I, that is spread out all over creation, with people whose only transportation is air, for example. And these people have to have some kind of transportation. If you deregulate, you probably will make it possible for some in various 600 places throughout the state to be victimized by fly-by-night operators of some kind. We have scheduled operators that are willing to provide a scheduled airline service between places. But they don't like it when an air taxi operator comes in and lands in front of them, takes their passengers. And if you do that for a couple of weeks with a scheduled airline, you're going to be hurting pretty bad. And so if you're going to regulate scheduled airlines to make sure that they continue their flying, then you're going to have to regulate the air taxi operator who might just come in and pick up those passengers at a few bucks extra or just enough for gas, or if he needs an insurance payment on his plane, picks up enough people for the premium. And so the scheduled operator, he's got to go in there, whether he likes it or not, with or without passengers. He's going to be hurt. So these are social problems for the state. I don't think I can sit here and advise anyone what to do with this problem. If you're going to regulate, regulate all the way, wholeheartedly. And if you're not going to regulate, get completely out of it entirely. But you can't do it halfway, and that's
what we're doing.
Well, what about the arguments that you can regulate market entry, but you don't have to regulate the price?
That's not an argument.
That's the worst combo.
That's the worst argument that anyone can make.
Well, it's been made here by several people. That is, people have said that with regard to cable television, it might be necessary to continue to regulate market entry and ensure that somebody's capable of providing the service and also have a complaint mechanism available later, and yet not to necessarily regulate price.
Well, tell them, fine, when you sell your certificate, turn the money back to the state.
Well, this is in areas where, at least so far, there's not been the abuses with regard to the certificates involved that have happened in the transportation of booze fields. It could happen.
But they're aiming for that, I'm sure. Sure being that I don't know what's in these men's minds, let's face it. But if you're asking for limited entry, you're asking for no competition. And if you're asking for no competition and no rate regulation, then you're asking for a means of making my company more valuable to me.
Well, I suppose in this area, maybe you'd have to agree, or I'll try to propose that you do and see if you don't. You don't have to do anything, but isn't there a little bit of difference between two guys having a couple of trucks in a town of 500 people and both wanting to provide service, which technically might come under the regulation of the ATC on the one hand, and two guys both saying that they're going to go ahead and buy a $30,000 earth station and put in a cable TV operation? Aren't there some, even though some of these generalizations seem to apply, and there are some areas where they really break down when you're talking about particular service?
Sure, I'd say let the truckers have the city. I mean, they just deregulate those people. Let anyone, because the truck is within the means of many a small businessman. And they can, you know, anybody who wants to buy a truck, go get a truck and do local hauling. Maybe the Transportation Commission wouldn't like this, but I see no problem with it.
The Teamsters Union wouldn't like it either.
And that earth station, if he doesn't receive some kind of protection, I assume you're not going to get the earth station. I wouldn't guess that there's a large number of people lined up out there that are going to spend that kind of money. The $30,000 is not very much anymore.
Okay, I do have some other questions. I also have a phone call I've got to take. I'm going to turn this back to Senator Strzelecki. Mr. Boone?
Yes.
I think Mr. Halford might want to continue an area of questions here.
I'll defer.
Well, just one thing, that as you came back to his response and said we can regulate entry and not regulate rates, I think there's another factor that we missed along the way there, and I think what APUC was discussing was regulating qualifications for entry, not necessarily regulating entry. Anyone who is qualified can enter, but you have to be qualified. So you're still talking about fit, willing, and able. You're not talking about public convenience and necessity. And there's a definite difference in, because really fit, willing, and able is not controlling entry. It's controlling qualifications of entry, but it's not controlling numbers or the competitive structure in terms of entry. And the regulation that I responded to being the worst combination is the regulation not of fit, willing, and able, but the regulation of entry without tariff.
Yes.
Mr. Bidworth, any further comment on that?
No.
Further question, Representative?
No, that's just...
Mr. Bowman?
Thank you, Senator Strzelecki. Mr. Bedsworth, in the absence of Mr. Randolph, perhaps I'll ask a pro forma question on his behalf. In discussing the citizen advocacy role or the public advocacy role and defining that as a necessary classification within any quasi-judicial body, couldn't it perhaps be propounded, though, that if the public does not choose to become involved in these particular proceedings, that it is an unwarranted intrusion on the part of the state to try and mandate a citizen activism role? Akin to that would be the potential for a heightened abuse akin to those public interests.
I think the legislature can define public interest and give those give that definition to the staff and as their mandate. This one, for example, says that to advocate and provide support for the lowest practicable rate under the circumstances. It seems to be a well-written law because it gives some flexibility to the staff, and yet it gives them a goal, lowest practicable rate. And if they don't pursue that, then apparently the staff is in violation of the law. Well, you know, sometimes it's very difficult to prove they're not doing a good job. But that's a policy goal. The Transportation Commission has several policy statutes, for example, and these are read at some length by attorneys and by people that appear. They argue those policy statements. Those are important. The legislature said the policy is, and they argue that the legislature, having said that, therefore I should or he should or something. And these policy statements are important. They provide long-term goals.
Ms. Bloom?
Then if I understand correctly, the policy goals to defend for the public interest or act as citizen advocate within the given body would have to be very precisely drawn so as to avoid the other side of the coin, which is a sudden proliferation of citizen activism beyond those basic guidelines. In other words, to avoid suddenly creating a contentious or dissenting body within a quasi-judicial organization.
The a regulatory agency, as I understand it, I know ATC is this way. If we step out of line in a significant manner, I don't know whether this is enough for you or not an answer, but if we step out of line in a significant manner, the Superior Court is quickly appealed to. And so I assume that if the staff with a public interest advocacy role was to become contentious, arbitrary, capricious, and so forth, that's using the power, the administrative power of the agency on industry in order to turn industry towards ways that over time an administrative agency can do, they could be brought up by court action.
Commissioner Guest, did you have a comment on that? Okay, excuse me. Did I cut you off?
No, that's all right. Yeah, that's good enough. I tend to run on if I'm not stopped by somebody.
I thought you were coming to a halt. I'm sorry.
Senator, Mr. Bedsworth, I understand the point that you are making. I think it necessary to at least have established that if a government agency is going to define both an economic regulatory role and a citizens advocacy role, I think that the point that the legislature might view with long fingers would be to what extent you would be setting up this potential mechanism for internal dispute or excessive zeal on the part of the staff. I only raise that as a discussion point to be subsequently explored.
We had a staff in the Kansas Corporation Commission, my only experience as a consumer advocate, we had five accountants that went out and audited the firm, came back. First of all, we had a pre-filed application. The auditors went out and came back. We'd sit down with the application, with all of the auditing information, and all of the ideas and thoughts of the various staff members, and we would make up the staff's case. Now, we would have the same concerns that any attorney would have in presenting his case. If we're too contentious, if we push too hard, if we appear to be punitive, appear to be shrieking hysterically about some imagined ill, the commissioners are not going to listen to us.
Why do you think lawyers do that?
Do what?
What you just described.
Oh, well, if they're good lawyers, they have to think ahead. How are they going to win? And if you're going to lose, you don't want to lose because you're a fool. You just want to lose because, you know, the merits of your case weren't adequate. If you go up and you pound tables
do you see a lot of lawyers appear before the commission at pound tables?
No, I wouldn't allow it. But we have an occasional mild altercation out in the hall.
With a smile.
But no, I think the desire to do a good job, and of course, this, your staffing has to be good too. You know, you're going to hire somebody with. Without all of his bells, I suppose, you know, you're going to have to live with that one for a while. But if you have the consumer advocates appearing, you have the industry advocates appearing, you have the commissioner or hearing officers sitting, you're going to have these people behaving themselves and presenting their case, trying to present evidence, and trying to argue in a reasonable manner for their point of view. And I don't believe we're going to have the drum beaters, not hearing.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, sir.
Where are we?
You're on. If he has any further comments, I think you're...
Anything further, Mr. Bedsworth?
No, sir, I have none.
Not spelled the same way and minus a syllable as Mr. Bedsworth, which is a different name.
Oh, are you Mr. Bedsworth?
Yes.
Oh, well, it's nice to meet you. I've been mistaken for you many times.
Yeah. You don't quite have that much hair, though, Bob.
No, I've been admiring your hair.
I believe...
What's in it? And also what's on it?
I think Mr. Breeze is not here. Is that correct? Mr. Breeze is not here. Mr. Renswold?
I'm Phil Renswold. I've come today strictly as a private citizen, a member of the public.
I won't interrupt with the questions. I think you've heard... on the basis of the kinds of things that we're interested in, your opinion on each of the same questions that keep coming up in addition to whatever your direct comments were going to be. The role of a hearing examiner, is it a general role? economic specialists, the division between economic regulation and market entry and whatever else you intended to talk about. So I'll just give you a blank slate after reminding you what the general questions have been.
Yes, and I'll try not to be repetitive, except perhaps just to mention points upon which I agree or my view is similar. I should say, in response to a question you asked, Mr. Bedsworth, that I don't have any reason to believe that the commission with which I'm employed would be opposed to my appearing here. However, because I'm here as a private citizen and not as an employee of the commission, I've taken some annual leave to account for these hours. And the reason I was interested in appearing is because I'm most concerned about recommendation number one, the merger of the commissions. And I, in the interest of time, won't really talk about anything else particularly. My experience in administrative law as a hearings examiner or administrative law judge goes back a long time. I was admitted to the bar in 1943, and about half of my professional life since that time has been in the area of administrative law as administrative law judge and hearings officer in three states, this being the third state, South Dakota, the state of Washington, and Alaska.
What years were those span?
Those are cumulative years, about 19, not consecutive, so that my first couple of years were...
I mean, from when to when in each state?
From 1947 to 49, and again from...
And that would be in the first state you indicated, South Dakota?
Where I was deputy industrial commissioner, and I sat as the court of original jurisdiction and a court of record on workman's compensation and occupational disease cases, because in that state there is no state fund. There wasn't at that time, and I'm quite sure there still is not. All employers coming under workman's compensation have purchased commercial coverage from insurance carriers. So by the time the claim got to my court, the insurance company and the claimant both had given up on one another and came in with lawyers. And, of course, the insurance company usually had two. And so then I would take the evidence, make findings of fact, draw conclusions of law thereupon, make up a written...
You're now in Washington, right?
This is South Dakota, and then I moved to Washington, where I sat on utilities and transportation, as well as health, education, welfare-type cases.
They had you were a generalized hearing examiner along the lines of the sort we're talking about?
Well, actually, in each instance, I was employed by a particular commission. It was in South Dakota. I was deputy industrial commissioner. We had a peculiar setup there. The attorney general was actually the industrial commissioner, ex officio, and then I was an assistant attorney general for a time, and for a couple of years was given the duty of being deputy industrial commissioner and doing what I just described. And then I went to Washington, where I, again, first was on the attorney general staff, and then became an administrative law judge, as they call that job down there, for the welfare department, and then later for the Washington Utilities and Transportation Commission.
So they do have it divided, and they have different people who are administrative law judges for different regulatory agencies?
Exactly,
yes.
There is some...
And that would be from what year to what year?
That...
In Washington.
In from 58 to 64. 66, I was on welfare type cases, disability cases in Washington, and then from 1967 to 72, when coming here, I was on utilities and transportation combined down there. And I've been with this commission since 72. I'm going into my eighth year with the Alaska Transportation
Commission. Does Washington State still have utilities and transportation combined?
Yes.
Hearing examiners in the same procedure that was in use when you were there?
Yes. It's a three-man commission, and they administer the laws affecting both utilities and transportation. And we hearings examiners, or administrative law judges, as they're called there, preside at both kinds of cases.
How many full-time administrative law judges did they have at the time you left in 70?
Five. There's an interesting article in the Administrative Law Journal of a couple of years back called Odyssey of an Administrative Law Judge, where he details his experience in sitting on various kinds of cases, The whole function of administrative law proceeding, as you gentlemen, ladies and gentlemen all know, is simply a fact-finding proceeding. And, of course, I think that, in my experience, the differences in many people's minds between the kinds of things one must do to effectively economically regulate utilities as compared to transportation are more imagined than real. The skills, the techniques, the methods, the procedures for arriving at the economic grist for the decisional mill, the economic data you need, come from essentially the same kinds of effort. In other words, economic regulation is economic regulation. You just, for example, in utilities, you speak of rate of return, and that's because you have high capital investment and fixed installations, and so you talk about rate of return.
Is there an easy index for the journal you referred to, and does one or the other of the commissions have a library that might keep back issues of administrative law journal?
Well, I can find that article for you.
I certainly would like to see a copy of that. It's, of course, that addresses one of the major questions we've been asking here.
Yes,
today.
I heard that earlier today this was raised. The man from Alaskom, I think, was the one who discussed it some. I'll find that for you, Mr. Brown. And actually, it seems to me that an administrative law judge is simply in the business of collecting facts. Obviously, he is under a professional obligation to understand those facts in order to construct a decision.
Well, she's not a lawyer, but she's a commissioner and became a lay member of the EPUC. But what you're saying means that if Carolyn Guess were suddenly finding herself on the ATC or as a hearing officer for the ATC, what she would see and hear would not seem all that foreign to her based on her experience?
I don't think it would. I don't think it would at all.
I don't mean to pick on you. I just thought it'd be an example.
No, I don't think that lawyers have any exclusive province here necessarily. I don't. I've been one for nearly 37 years, but since 43. But I don't think they have any exclusive province here. One of the best title
for
real estate.
Me feel young again. I'm starting to feel old. I just passed my 10th year at the bar.
Well, I'm 60, and I got a lot more miles on me. But I think of a person like one I knew in Olympia who was a layman as to law. I don't suppose he'd ever been inside a law school, but when it came to title and real estate law, he was a lawyer's lawyer. In fact, he'd get calls from lawyers all over the state on questions of title law, real estate law.
I know that your role has been as a hearing officer, administrative law judge. The parallel question that I asked of several witnesses was, not with regard to your field, but you deal with that subject matter all the time, and that was with regard to the staff expertise in economic regulation. Is that as general, do you think, in your experience, so that someone as a highly skilled tariff specialist for transportation would not fall apart trying to learn telephone rate separations or other similar areas?
Someone who understands rate structure can move from transportation utilities and back again. My first exposure to any formal training along this line was at the University of Colorado in Boulder back in 10 or 12 years ago. And there are different places where one can pick these things up. Part of the project, the proposal, the program of the state is to offer to its employees continuing education to improve their professional skills. And of course, such places are available too. Employees for training. I've been to the National Judiciary College at the University of Nevada twice, second time at their invitation as a faculty advisor. And there you pick up the other side of the picture, the other side of the other group of skills one needs to preside properly, and that's where you get mostly the procedural skills for handling hearings. So I'm kind of getting my comments disjointed here somewhat. I wanted to make mention of the fact that it seems curious to me that there should be a terribly great concern about a public advocate appearing at administrative law proceedings before an economic regulatory commission because maybe the theory has fallen apart in actual practice, but the theory, of course, obviously is that the commission itself is supposed to be representative of the public. It's a creature of the legislature. It used to be in years gone by, you know, that the legislature would set rates And then when, of course, this became unmanageable, then they created agencies for this purpose because the detail was just simply swamping the legislatures.
Well, after the Sunset Review last year and this year, Rick, for instance, would you like to be setting the rates instead?
I wouldn't like to be negotiating employee pay raises either in about the same thing.
No, we have a choice.
It isn't a practical thing, but
the House does.
But it seems to me that we, in Alaska, I'm struck by the size of state government. I was overwhelmed with the size of the Washington state government, having come from South Dakota, which I realize Eleanor Roosevelt once called Darkest America. But nevertheless, I was overwhelmed with the size of Washington state government, and I've been just staggered by the size of Alaska state government, proportionately speaking.
Per capita.
Oh, it's fantastic. There was an article in Alaska Fest, that free magazine you get on Alaska Airlines. I came back from Fairbanks. I've been at a hearing last week, and the economist banker Bob Richards had an article on the back page, and he mentioned again, as he has before, that Alaska state government is 3.5 times what it is in most states. Well, if you take
that's
that factor,
on a per capita basis.
On a proportionate basis, yes. Per capita. And if you,
if you have 400,000 people and they're spread across 2 or 3 square blocks, it might be a little easier and cheaper to provide government services.
That's true.
Mr. Richards is noted for having a certain political bent to his.
Oh, yes. That's true. But I thought it was kind of interesting because. Yeah, he probably has. But
elephants over here.
I have been active politically in any party, so I don't have anything to grind in the way of politics. But taking that 3.5% factor and multiplying it times the usual 3 commissioners you have in most states regulating utilities and transportation, and multiplying 3 times 3.5 gives you 10.5, and we've got 11 commissioners here.
Which ones you count? Maybe you've left on.
Well, I left there are 3 transportation,
5,
3 pipeline, and 5 utilities.
You left out the Alcohol Beverage Control Board.
Well, and I didn't count the fisheries. but it seems to me really excessive because I don't personally think it's necessary for
By implication, does that mean that you're not too shocked by the recommendation of the auditor that the 3 agencies be combined?
Oh, I'm not shocked at all. I think it's long overdue. of course, the Alaska Transportation Commission is not the way it has functioned in a true sense, an economic regulatory agency. I guess the committee is well aware of that because it doesn't really have a handle on rates. If it did, the carriers themselves wouldn't be publishing their tariffs. But the carriers do publish their own tariffs, and in the state of Washington, the commission publishes the tariffs. As a result of analyses made by staff rate analysts, and then when the annual reports come in from the carriers down there, routinely if there's something suspect or not clear about the annual reports, the carrier has to undergo a field audit by auditors coming out of the commission who bill the cost of the audit to the carrier. They're room and board and the whole ball of wax, just like individual banks bear the cost of bank examiners coming in periodically, as they must. But that's regulation, and it's onerous, it's burdensome to the carriers. Here, there seems to be a disposition on the part of carriers to want the commission to continue as is, because I suspect, because really, in effect, it's a limited entry commission. More than it is an economic regulatory commission.
That seems to be consistent with what we heard earlier and what we heard during our Sunset hearings.
Yeah.
The commission seems to have the responsibility to do it, but somehow it's never quite worked.
Yeah. Well, I don't know why. When I first came aboard, I was a little surprised that
it's also argued to me that the APUC, it didn't really work very well until rather recently, the last 4, 5, 6 years on some areas of economic regulation.
But I think there's a serious question in Alaska whether people really want economic regulation. I don't think that they have seen it or had it so that they know whether they want it or not. If they had experienced it, true economic regulation, my guess would be that Alaskans being what they are, get rid of it, you know? I mean, we're just not the kind of people who want to put up with that, because it is putting up with a lot.
Unless, of course, the guy's got a certificate of public convenience and necessity in the closet, so.
Yeah, that he's holding against today, as has already been mentioned, when he hopes to sell it for a good bundle and retire. whatever. But it just isn't, I just don't think we got it in the regulation in Alaska. But people have believed that we've had it.
Well, clearly you don't see any objection to it. You think that the recommendation on merger, and you think it's quite consistent with your view of public interest. Do you have any general comments on the other, on the generalized problems that result from that, or a transition to that, or any other comments about some other part of the audit?
Mr. Chairman, I do apologize. I simply cannot stay any longer. I apologize to this witness and any others that come, and will avail myself of additional information and appreciate
two or three left, I think.
The joint meeting, even though I was the only one from the Senate Commerce, I still think it was a valiant effort and appreciate that.
Well, I hope that Mr. Lee can hang the last dog with us and therefore tell you who got hung or whatever.
Fine, that's fine. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Senator. Go ahead.
You asked about any problems merging the commissions?
Or any other comments you have.
Well, if the ATC or its function is to be continued somehow, there's some things that ought to really be given attention, it seems to me. In most states where there's economic regulation of carriers, they are not permitted to extend credit. It's a strict, it's a violation of law.
Is that similar to what we know in the booze area in this state?
Yeah, same
idea. For instance, a wholesaler can't extend credit to a retailer, and a retailer's not supposed to let you run a tab, although if the ABC hasn't been around lately, they might try.
Yeah, but it's even more burdensome, I think, economically to the community of the state than the restriction against credit in the booze business is, because a carrier, although I can't prove this, it could be worked up, I suppose, as a study, but I simply can only make it as an assertion that a carrier who has difficulty collecting his collectibles, his bills, that is the money he's owing him, can just as easily as not throw in the sponge and say, write it off as a bad debt and get a break on his income tax and increase his tariff. And I think it could be shown that probably this is what happens. Another problem with carriers in this state, as far as existing legislation is concerned, they're exempt from the antitrust provisions.
Oh boy, don't I know it.
And then we don't have what's a commonplace amongst statutory provisions in most states, and that's an affiliated interest statute. Now the Pipeline Commission got its own passed. It struck me as curious.
APUC has.
The APUC, but the Pipeline Commission is the newer act, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, and that's what reason it stuck in my mind. I thought it was peculiar in a way that since a pipeline is only a carrier after all, which is why the ICC regulates both wheeled carriers and pipelines, and why it seems to me redundant to have a pipeline commission and a transportation commission, because a pipeline is a carrier and very, very often a common carrier. The concerns of regulating economically are essentially the same. Same celebrations have to be performed in order to get the job done. There again, with a pipeline, perhaps more like a utility. And incidentally, carriers in the old days used to be called public utilities. There's a big fixed installation with a high capital investment. And there you talk about rate of return as opposed to operating ratio when you're talking about a surface or air carrier. That is a surface carrier other than pipeline. I think those are about the only random thoughts I have on this. I'm not a national authority at all, but if I can, I'll answer questions.
I think this gives to rise of something I obviously should have requested last year, or somebody else should have, maybe somebody else did it, and I don't know. Maybe we should request of the agency, Legal Services Division, and if Mr. Lee, if House Commerce could prevail on you to request it for both committees, since Mr. Bloom's leaving back until January 2 or something, basically a simple analysis of the kinds of differences that exist between the regulatory agencies affected by sunset last year and this year, and the ones that are in the APC. For instance, I didn't, even though I dealt all last year with ATC, I didn't realize they didn't have an affiliated interest statute, because I probably kept thinking in terms of the APUC and just assuming that I'd seen it there, because I knew that APUC had one, and I think I knew that the Pipeline Commission, and the other areas you mentioned where there were some differences,
Of course, we know that the ATC has their own little goody way on how they get paid, and we know how that happened.
Yeah, that was
an
interesting maneuver.
Yes, it was. And what was the other area you mentioned?
Well, I mentioned carriers being allowed to extend credit.
And that's in the regulatory scheme itself. So not just with regard to the commissioners and their status, but also differences in the regulatory scheme
about
credit.
They're being exempt from antitrust.
Excuse me, Representative Brown, did you want our legal staff?
No, no, our legal staff, legal services division. No, something that's not a long, complicated memo, but maybe a one or two tabulated thing. APUC, ABC, which some of the stuff won't apply to booze.
You want a real services.
Transportation Commission. And then just down, you know, here's the item, yes, no, maybe, all the way across, so we could just have it kind of graphic.
Mr. Chairman, if I might suggest to Mr. Lee that probably the best tool on that would be Dick Bradley and Dave Walker.
They could probably do it off the top of their head, practically.
I might interrupt. It's my understanding that each agency has been asked to review its statute and specifically to go through section by section. And I think somebody in your shop, and I know someone in my shop, has already done it and submitted it to the Department of Commerce. So the work, you know, a lot of the work may have been done, and I would think that an inquiry to Commissioner Weber, because I know the directive came to our commission, and it was done by the deputy director.
Well, if those are available to us, certainly any reports of that sort that Commissioner Weber can provide to both committees would probably be helpful. But I still think that if one of the other of those two staffers could give us not a real long memo, but just basically a graph, so you can kind of, you know, graphically see what the differences are. If you're going to merge one, two, or three of them, or not merge them, but have them use the common staff, what kind of problems are you going to have when, as Representative Miles says, you're changing what sheet of music you're reading?
Mr. Chairman, it might be appropriate to feed that request also to Mr. Reed. I believe he does have people on board, and we could get that possibly as fast for the research.
Oh, yes, maybe House Research. Just get Mr. Reed in touch.
He can feed it to House Research?
Through us, he will. Between Mr. Reed and Billy Barrier and his people, whoever can do it most easily and quickly should do it. That's basically it. I think that was my final interruption. I don't know whether that was your final comment or not.
Mr.
Bettisworth?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I appreciated your comments about the size of state government as compared to Washington State and North Dakota, where you previously worked. South Dakota, the Dakotas. The number of commissioners that we have and the number of hearing officers and so forth is compared to the size of the agencies you work for outside. Could you or would you care to comment on why we're behind in our work when we apparently have a much larger staff to do the work up here than other states have? Why the different APUC and ATC are...
Well, the euphemism administrative lag is applied to that. But actually, the ATC has, believe it or not, improved since it got hearings officers. In fact, I was recruited from the outside. I didn't look for the job looked for me. They came after me, and I didn't know when I got aboard how bad the backlog was. I thought I knew, but I didn't. And actually, there were...
It was a matter of years then, wasn't it, in 72?
Late 72. Actually, I came aboard in November 72.
Yeah, what was the lag? A matter of 2, 3, 4 years in some cases?
Oh, yes. And over 500 open cases. It was really frightful when I began to find out how far behind they were. And this is understandable because the three commissioners had attempted to sit on the hearings themselves and simply got away from them. The volume just wasn't manageable by. And then I'd been aboard 2 years when Bedsworth came along. He came early in 75. I was there for 73, 74, and then he came aboard in January, I think, of 75. And now we're comparatively, current. By that I mean, I don't think, there are always a few cases that get hung up for one reason or another, that is mostly because of some appeal to the courts or some interlocutory interim hang-up of some kind or another, usually outside our control, I don't think our cases now, any of them are older than 8 or 9 months.
Let me ask a follow-up to Mr. Bettisworth's question, or maybe another version of the same question. That is, we have more commissioners total in areas of economic regulation.
Yes.
Do we also have more staff, support staff, compared to, say, the areas of economic regulation
in
Washington?
I think it's entirely top-heavy commissioners.
That's where... If I might interrupt, on page 46B, the information we have, Mr. Renville, the average regulatory commission in the United States has approximately 200 staff members. The APUC has 32. I don't know what the Transportation Commission
is. About 23 or 4.
What? I've got a question here that ties this a little bit. What's the budget of APUC?
I'm trying to get out of here.
This year, our budget request is approximately $1,000,004.
What was last year? Just so you, the request is kind of not necessarily what it was. That's easier to compare.
What did we get?
Yeah.
The across-the-board decrease that everybody got, which was approximately a 5% decrease, so it was less. It's $1,000,003 something. We got the same.
So you've got 6 or 8 more employees and about the same budget the Transportation Commission's got.
About, I think.
Close to $1 million of ours is personal services. No consulting money.
Okay, would you say that the commissions work equally as efficiently up here in man hours on a particular case as they did in your previous experiences?
Well, no, they don't. For one thing, we never had a hearing in Washington that didn't produce a transcript. And I personally can work, without exaggeration, 4 to 5 times as fast with a transcript as I can with tapes, real-to-real tapes is what we ordinarily have. Now, that sounds like an exaggeration, but I'm sure it's not. From my years of experience, I think that's a fair estimate.
So are we being penny-wise and pound-foolish then, just because transcripts are expensive?
Yeah, but there's an easier way to get around that. Now, Edsworth's familiar with from the Kansas Commission with a setup where they had somebody on staff who took the transcript and typed it up. That was their primary responsibility. The thing about that that's so beautiful, and I've tried to sell it, but it's never gone anywhere. I'm a lousy salesman, obviously. To have somebody on staff who comes on the job understanding that when a hearing is to be held, their primary job is to be the court reporter for that proceeding and to make up a transcript. And of course, you see in every kind of effort, like utilities, transportation, whatever, you have a peculiar nomenclature that applies, certain expressions that are meaningful only within the particular field. And so when these things are farmed out, you get back some of the most weird conglomerations of words.
Or the old excuse, inaudible.
Inaudible.
The transcriber didn't understand the word of art, so they pretended that they'd been mumbled.
Yeah.
If I might add, also, because of the location of both commissions in the McKay building and the noise from the street and the airplanes from Merrill Field, that accounts for at least 50% of the inaudibles and renders some transcripts absolutely useless.
Yeah, there are some true inaudibles, that's right. But you're also right, Mr. Brown.
The court system and private depositions is my experience that they're... You know, there's nothing wrong with a damn tape, and somebody is in a hurry to get it out, so the excuse is inaudible.
Yeah.
Just go on from there.
I've had to reconstruct transcripts and spend literally days at it, which is really a terrible waste of time. It should have been done right in the first place. And it would have been had there been somebody on staff who gets used to these terms of art and is there on the spot, sees the person talking, the witness testifying, and gets it. You know, you do a lot of lip reading when you're watching somebody. Subconsciously you do that and you fit the thing together. And then you get a transcript which you can sell, the commission can sell to the parties and recoup its cost and possibly even pay for the salary of the person who does the job. And sell it probably cheaper than you could get it from outside.
We're going to have lobbyists for R&R depositions coming in and beating our foreheads if we try
to depose it. That's the way Kansas did it. Down in Washington, they let a contract out to a reporting firm every third year on a competitive bid. And boy, that was beautiful. We got the reporter traveled independently to the place of hearing, wherever it was in the state. He showed up, and he always had a stenotype, and a backup recording machine. And we got a transcript, except in the very longest hearings, within 2 weeks. They were letter perfect and beautiful thing.
Mr. Chairman, I might point out, though, that the state of Colorado currently licenses and examines reporters.
So we have another board out of 24 boards. Out of the Civil Aeronautics Board does that. I remember a very attractive young lady who came for the Alaska Service investigation. And was,
She did the same thing, both stenotype. One war story, and I'll stop. If you really want to hear the worst case of this I've ever heard of, talk to the chief clerk of the House of Representatives about what it was like to try to reconstruct after years and years a transcript from the tapes of the debates of the Alaska Constitutional Convention.
Oh, I'll bet.
She was involved in that project. Apparently they pulled people out of their deathbeds to try to recognize voices, and it was just a bloody mess.
Well, that'd be a horrible job.
Could I just make a comment that I hope is germane in this regard? The problem with the selling of the transcripts is this one. And we've been working around it for a number of years, and maybe we've come up with an idea for the 81 budget. But if we would sell the transcript, the money goes back into the general fund. It doesn't come back to us to renew the transcript fund, but rather it goes into the general fund. So we have no idea how much money our commission doesn't know whether we're going to get an Alascom mm-hmm. or an Anchorage cable TV or something like this, and all of a sudden you run out of money.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's partly because of our constitutional restriction, but the way to do that politically, of course, is to have a reasonable estimate of the transcript revenues attributed to the and then agency receipts, which go in the general fund, but also it's more defensible to argue then that a portion of your budget should be increased or allocated because of that. Even though we don't allow dedicated funds, you can do an end run that way. I don't know if I agree with the philosophy of it, but it's done all the time.
Mr. Chairman, I'd just make a point here that Mr. McConkie's Regulation Reform Task Force right now is supposedly going to be coming in with some new proposed statutory changes to allow a certain measure of pay-as-you-go for any of these agencies that are so obligated to provide this service. The quality of that legislation I have no idea of right now, but it is rather aggressively being sold by a number of the boards and commissions that are up under sunset right now that have been caught in much the same box. There may be an alternative to a dedicated fund, but still a mechanism available to any and all of these agencies to deal with that particular high-cost operation.
And then we're going to crack open the door in the government and try to make it apply in theory to oil companies and booze merchants, too. Oh, well. Anything further, or parting shot, or anything you think you missed?
No, I don't think of anything further. It's been pretty random, I realize. I've tried to not lean on things that have been covered by other people.
To emphasize what you said, did you make the statement concerning the merger? It was long overdue, and you definitely were in favor of it.
I personally think so, because my experience has been from other states that it can be done efficiently, but you assume with that that you have competent, qualified staff personnel to keep the machinery going. I think the commissioner's jobs essentially ought to be policy making and public actually, they're the commissions, the regulatory commissions, if you're going to have them, and I'm not a real gung-ho enthusiastic bureaucrat, obviously, but if you're going to have economic regulation, then I think probably you better be sure that it is regulation so that people know what they're getting for their money, and then make up their minds whether they really like it and want it or not, whether it's even necessary. This is probably not a very judicious thing to say in a way. It just seems to me sometimes that Alaska, when it became a state, leaped into the business of being a state and said, we've got to have a regulatory commission on transportation, we've got to have a regulatory commission on this and this and this and this, because other states have it, without really knowing, for sure.
We also ruined our good educational system and did almost the same damage to our public university with this saying we've got to do it outside because there must be something inferior about us because we're the frontier. I saw that happen over the last 25 years too.
Well, there must have been quite a climate for this, because it seems to me the state government has just gotten so voluminously huge proportionately in this state that it just got completely overdone.
You think we ought to have fewer commissioners all in the same place and possibly slightly more staff, but all working for the same commission handling everything?
Well, the commissions are the creatures of the legislature. The legislature gives birth to them. The legislature is the body you look to as representative of the public interest in the first instance. And since they can't handle the detail, history has developed this business of the legislatures all over the country creating these commissions. And these commissions are the arm of the legislature in one sense, and supposed to embody the public to accomplish the administration of these laws. The commissioners themselves are supposed to be the embodiment of the public. That's why I can't get too excited about this business of having a consumer advocate represented in every every hearing where there might conceivably be some possible, you know, rather amorphous, undefined, quote, public interest, unquote. It's all in the public interest.
Well, isn't there a problem, though? That might be your motivation as a, if you were a commissioner. On the other hand, you know, I'm sure as an administrative law judge, hearing officer, and as a lawyer, the dilemma that the commissioner has, if he suspects or privately thinks that there ought to be more in the record than there is in with regard to what he thinks the public interest is, but because the only parties before him are the big, well-heeled private entities, there's nobody else there to expand the record. And if he tries to do anything else, he's going to be reversed as a for denial of due process on appeal. That's the argument that the people who are in favor of a consumer advocate role make when they counter what you just said.
Well, I can see that argument. I think there's a certain amount of reasonableness to it. On the other hand, maybe an alternative way of getting at that would be better. Maybe somehow a better means of publicizing a particular proceeding with an open invitation, because these all are public open hearings, for the public to come in. And when you've made as sure as you can that everybody who might conceivably be interested in getting in his two bits worth knows about it, and nobody shows up, then you don't have a built-in system where you've got a so-called public advocate in there who's got to do his job, even if it means fabricating up, in essence, you know, manufacturing a case to present, whether there's any real substance underlying it in the sense of there being a public interest or not.
Frequently the result then is the commission makes a decision and then somebody from the public comes in and screams bloody murder. Kind of like an analog to this committee sitting listening to a bunch of people from a certain organization represented in the room 2 weeks or a week and a half or 2 weeks after we'd had our sunset hearings on the Alaska Transportation Commission, saying, we haven't been informed.
Yeah, I suppose that there's no way really around that problem, but I don't know. It seems to me that, I don't know, I don't have too firm an opinion on it one way or the other, I guess, when it comes right down to it, except that it just seems to me that we're probably adding another element that doesn't always, in every case, have utility, have use, a reason for being.